Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Siegel. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Kinga Phillips. And before we get to Kinga, I have a few announcements. First, our website is traveltalespodcast.com, and there you'll find stories that I've written, stories that some of the guests have written. You'll find links to their social media. You'll find links to our social media, and that is, of course, Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. That's the big one. If you could follow us there, I'd appreciate it. We have a Facebook page. Follow us there as well. And speaking of following, I'm sure most of you listen to this on a streaming device of some sort. Maybe it's Apple Podcasts, maybe it's Spotify, maybe it's iHeartRadio, whatever it is. I ask you to A, please subscribe, and B, give us a good rating. That helps more people find the show. It boosts our presence there, and that's a cool thing if you can do it. If you think you'd be right for the show, or maybe you know somebody who's right for the show, or maybe you want to write me and ask me travel questions, or just tell me I'm an awesome dude, you can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. Kinga Phillips first did our show way back in March of 2019, pre-COVID, pre the world stopping. So it's been 6 years since she's been on the show, and she has done a ton. If you'd like a deeper dive into Kinga's background, go listen to that episode. It's still up there online. She was born in Poland. Her parents moved to the U.S. She made her way to Hollywood. And oddly enough, she and I had the same hosting agent for a number of years back in the old days. And like me, she hosted a lot of TV shows over the years, all over the map, red carpet stuff, journalism stuff. But then she really honed in and found her niche. Is it niche? Niche? However you want to say it. Her niche. And that was travel adventure shows. And since then, she's hosted things for National Geographic Channel and Sci-Fi Travel Channel. And the thing about Kinga is she's always very active, always doing stuff like surfing or scuba diving or adventuring, going through caves or jumping out of planes, whatever the activity, she's up for it. But she's done a number of shows with the Travel Channel and Epix and the BBC, and she does a lot of her own producing these days. In 2021, she became the first female host in 33 years of her own show on Discovery's Shark Week. It was called Tiger Queen, where she went to the Turks and Caicos and swam with the tiger sharks. Then she did another show called Sharks in Paradise, and she's become almost synonymous with sharks. She's like the queen of sharks. Loves them. I literally ran into Kinga a couple months ago when I was in Miami. I had a layover at the airport near the hotel. I was going to breakfast, and she walked by me. And at first, I didn't recognize her, but after about 5 feet, I looked backwards, and she looked backwards. And at first, I didn't recognize her, but I kept walking. Then after about five steps, I looked back, and then she looked back and went, "Hey!" And it was great to see her. She was on her way to catch a flight. So I vowed, you got to do the show again just to catch up with all you've been doing. So we talked this week, and lo and behold, Shark Week is coming up. And of course, she has a new show out. She couldn't talk about it too much, but she's doing a show with Tom Bergeron, the former host of Dancing with the Stars, America's Funniest Home Videos, and a million other shows. You know Tom Bergeron. Everybody knows him. So look for that this July. And if you want to see all the stuff she's done, go to kingofphillips.com, 1L, 2Ps, and follow her at King of Phillips on Instagram and all the other social media. I've always admired Kinga for finding her own way in this business and working hard and staying on television and doing it herself. And most of all, doing what she loves. And what she loves is usually underwater, so it was great to finally see her above water and get to talk to her again. Here's my chat with the shark queen herself, Kinga Phillips. It was great to run into you in Miami, because it's just odd not only seeing you out and about and in all places in a hotel lobby in Miami, but also seeing you out of the water, which is strange.
Aww.
It's like seeing...
Well, I was coming from water.
Right. It's like seeing it like a wild animal in the, outside of its normal habitat. So where were you coming from? Yeah. Where were you coming from?
I was jumping from Grand Bahama, where we had filmed Shark Week, to St. Croix, where I was scouting for Shark Week and also visiting my dear friend Cindy, and then trying to get back home. And when I ran into you, it was actually like such a great moment of just like zen, because I remember asking you, like, what? Your brain just triggers because you see someone, like you said, like it's like seeing your teacher at a school and you're like, wait, no, what?
Yeah.
And we both turned around and we're like, wait a minute. And it was so perfect because I was so grumpy because I had overnighted in Miami because our flight from St. Croix had been delayed by like 10 hours, missed my connection the night before, and then had to put myself up and then obviously do the whole like rigmarole with airlines. Like, you're going to pay for this, right? You're going to pay for this. Oh, you're out of vouchers, are you? Well, let me send this in and see if you'll actually reimburse me. So it was, but I made it home and it was great. And they did actually reimburse me after much emailing. So it was
great. Good. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those airport hotels that we're all forced to stay in at some point when we can't. Yeah, because like I was working on a cruise ship and they fly me in the night before. So they just like they got a deal, you know, with the hotel. So it's just transients there, just people passing through.
We're total transients.
Yeah. So you mentioned Shark Week. So why don't we just go right into that? Tell your are you an executive producer now, or what's happening here?
So I try to executive produce as many of the shows that I create as possible. And then I also host them and I'm on camera with them. So I've been doing Shark Week shows. I think I'm on number 5. I got to do 3 this year. It's going to start July 20th of this year, which is really exciting. So I did 3. I executive produced one of them. And then in the past, I've done 2 others that I also executive produced and I created one. So the first one I ever did, I got to be the first female host of Shark Week in 33 years, which was the coolest thing ever. I shed some tears over that. And also I created it. It kind of went backwards because we created a show in 2021 in French Polynesia. I flew out there, found these tiger sharks, created the show, and then French Polynesia got shut down because of COVID. So we were like, no curses, you know, shakes this universe. And we rerouted and did an awesome show called Tiger Queen and Turks and Caicos. And that became the first Shark Week show I ever did. And then we went back in 2022 and did Sharks in Paradise in French Polynesia. And then this year we did one in Saba, which was awesome.
Is this all Discovery?
Discovery? Yes.
Okay.
Shark Week has been on Discovery for 33 years, and now National Geographic does Shark Fest, which is really similar.
Yeah, I get them confused. It's like, are these shark shows, or are they just going to be rerunning Jaws for the, you know, for that week? Or you wonder, like Sharknado or whatever, stupid movie. Yeah.
It's hard to keep up at this point.
It's like, who doesn't have a Shark Week?
Exactly.
Okay, so you were, I guess, I don't know, how long have you been in... independently producing your own content as opposed to being hired as a host?
Gosh, well, I mean, you know, you're in the industry too, so you know how it goes. And it's changed a lot over the years. So it used to be kind of a pretty standard. We'd have an agent or a manager and they'd have breakdowns and we'd get submitted and we'd audition, you know, or, you know, we'd take a meeting and we'd have a show. And that has very much shifted. Like these days, you know, every now and then I will get a call, usually within the genre that I'm in, which is oceans and sharks. Like 2 of the Shark Week shows this year came to me because they said, hey, the guys at Discovery said, you know, you'd be good for this. And so they came to me, which was lovely and flattering and amazing. But very often it is me scouting and building and creating my own shows. And that's not just for Shark Week. You know, it's been a good while since it's gone the route of, you know, the former glory of just being hired for a show. And I do like to produce my own shows because I like the creative aspect of it. I like having control of the content and, you know, the story. I think that's really important, especially when it comes to sharks, because I'm really passionate about them. But yeah, it's a different game out there now. We really create a lot of our own shows for all the different platforms out there.
So what comes first? Did you go shoot this thing or you find a place, or do you go pitch it and say, hey, look, I just dove at this place. There's a show in it. How much of the budget comes out of your pocket, or how much do they put up, or do you just taking a big risk and hope you can sell it?
So great question. And it's kind of a little bit of all of the above. So I've actually found this really cool niche where I'll get invited a lot to go on press trips. And for years, you know, I was like, oh, you know, do I really want to go on these press trips? Like, you're not getting paid for it, but you are going to cool places, but I travel for a living. Like, oh, do I want to do that? And then finally I was like, yeah, you know what, I do. And in between shows, I would start taking these press trips and I would take them to places that I was really passionate and excited about. And oftentimes those places are ocean oriented. So when I went out to French Polynesia, I actually worked with Tahiti Tourism, and I said to them, I said, listen, I'm always scouting for projects. So I am happy to like write an article. I'm happy to do some media for you guys, but also like I'm really interested in scouting. And so I've started to use these press trips as scouting missions. And I think in 2023, my friend Justin Walter and I went to Saba Island, and we went out there. We had so much fun. Like, we did some press for them. We did some social media for them. And while we were there, I was like, let me meet all the local shark scientists. And I kind of knew that the Saba Bank was this really cool spot for sharks. And so I got to meet Kai Wolf, who's one of the local shark scientists out there, and Ayumi, and they were lovely. And then with that, I kind of built a show around it, and I created a narrative, and then I pitched it to one of the production companies. And then from there, that was greenlit by Discovery. But there are other shows where you're spending your own money. There's one in Florida right now that we're really excited about. And that one is actually with a production company, but it hasn't been greenlit yet. But the sharks only show up for a month out of the year. So we're like, we're not going to wait for them to greenlight. We need to film this. So I fly myself out. I put myself up. You know, my buddy Shane, like, he's the cinematographer. We get the tanks. We rent all of our gear and we pay for it. And then just hope we get reimbursed on the back end.
Oh, boy. Did, well, Justin Walter, thank you for bringing him up. I'm trying to get him back. He's a friend of the show. He's already been on. Did, how much of that, I always make the same joke, but how much of that trip did he wear a shirt? Was it at any point?
This is what I say to people, and I have to tell you, it's so funny. I love Justin so much. He is probably my number one travel friend that I just, we just get on like gangbusters. We travel the world together. And he's obviously the most like physically fit human on the planet.
I know.
And it constantly, whether I'm on a newscast, a podcast, on my social media, people in the most loving way possible are like, does that guy ever wear a shirt? And my comment back is always the same. If you looked like that, would you? And I'm like, if I looked like that, I would never. I'd be in a bikini all the time if I looked right. Like that. So that's my answer. No, he does not wear a shirt, and I don't blame him one bit.
Yeah, it's so funny. I bust Justin's balls all the time about that, but it's like, it's so obvious. Yeah, if I had abs, I probably wouldn't wear shirt much either. But so God bless him, and I can tell him as an older guy, he should enjoy it while he can. So Saba, you said Saba, mm-hmm. Right? Spell that, because I'm trying to figure out where it is.
Saba. So I had never even heard of Saba until really just kind of found it on the map. So it is one of the Dutch Caribbean islands, and it is very close to St. Martin. Oh. And it's really, I believe it's a 20-mile channel, something like that. Don't quote me exactly on that. But it also has the shortest commercial runway in the world. So when you fly from St. Martin to Saba, you are hanging on for dear life. And the visual flying in is just the coolest. And these pilots are real good at what they do, fortunately, because it's a hair-raising adventure to get there.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So that show, I mean, are all these shows out there online that we can see that you've done?
They're not yet. So they will start announcing them. So Shark Week airs July 20th, and this Saba show, which I'm not even sure what the title is ultimately, and then two other shows that I can't mention yet, those will probably get announced the week before Shark Week airs.
Yeah, over the years, I mean, you were like me, you hosted a lot of different stuff too. I mean, you did a lot of stuff on land. It's not all water-based. So yeah. Did you ever think that this was going to be your niche? Like, you're the shark girl?
You know, I knew that nature, conservation, travel, adventure has always been my niche. You know, I can't even say that. Like, my niche has gone from Food Network to cars to red carpets. It's been everything. No, I am the jack of all trades. But I think in recent years, that has really narrowed to travel, but in an adventurous way that is also conservation oriented. And then the ocean has become a really big space for me. And I think that just sort of developed because there weren't a lot of women crossing over into that. You know, it was when I started hosting, there just really weren't a lot of women doing adventure travel to begin with. But then when it started to go into the ocean space and I had the hosting background, I also had the ocean conservation background. I think that kind of opened some doors for me, which was really great. And it also has just become a point of passion.
I mean,
so I found myself in the ocean space.
Do you still see yourself like doing more, going back to land, or are you going to stick with this for a while?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think there are some really great shows and some great documentaries in particular that I gravitate towards. I mean, I think Shark Week has sort of become my niche, but that's really just a couple shows a year. And, you know, from a survivability standpoint, a financial standpoint, you can't exist on just a show or three shows a year, especially when they're one-off. So I'm always looking for whatever the next project is, whether that is land-based or ocean-based. But I think in the last 10 years, it's really all been travel adventure, sort of like a documentary style show. And those are the shows that come to me when I am approached about a show. You know, no one's coming to me going, hey, can you do fashion?
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
Hey, a niche or a niche or whatever you say it.
I've said it like 12 different ways now.
Yeah.
Yes, I've said it 12 different ways.
It's important. You know what I mean? I mean, that's all we have. As we get older, especially too, it's just like there's a lot you can't just do everything anymore. I mean, I hosted a lot of different. I did a home show, I did music, I did game shows and stuff like that. That's not really those jobs aren't really out there anymore. So
we're the old guard.
Yeah, but the internet is all niche. You know what I mean? But you got to find your little piece of it. It may not be the biggest audience, but if you find your piece of it, that's all you really need. You know,
absolutely. I do think there's something to be said for being, you know, the word expert is overused too. Like when social media really first started, I would always laugh. I was like, oh, you put a fireman's hat on and suddenly you're an expert firefighter. Yeah. Like if you have one photo as a fireman, like, oh, there you are. You're an expert firefighter. So I think the word expert is a little, it's loosey-goosey, right? Like I would never even call myself a shark expert. There are people out there who know far more than I do. I'm a conservationist. I love sharks. Like I have some knowledge about them, but I don't even like to be referred to as an expert. But I remember years ago, there was an agent. Did you know John Paradise?
Yeah, he was my agent.
He was your agent too. Okay.
He was my agent. Yeah.
So I love John, and John was ahead of his time. And we're talking like 20 years ago now.
Yeah. I wasn't going to bring it up, but I'll let you go ahead.
Let me just say that. Like I said, we're the old guard.
Yeah.
And John was really brilliant. And I remember when he came to me, I was working for Current TV, which was Al Gore and Jill Hyatt's network at the time. And he said to me, and he goes, I see things going in a certain direction. And he goes, I'm telling you, hosts are going to disappear and you need to find your niche. What else did right. I say? What you need to find your niche, and you really need to figure out what it is that's organic to you, that's authentic. It can't be like forced or fake, and steer in that direction. And if there's something that like really just appeals to you, become an expert in that. Like make your statement in that space. Like do posts, write articles, do whatever you need to do so that you've got some like gravitas in that area. And that was probably the most brilliant advice he ever gave me because I sat with it. And like I said, at that time I had done car shows and food shows and red carpet shows. I worked for Fox Sports. I did sports shows. I did everything. And I really sat and thought about it. And I was like, I really love like adventure, travel, conservation, all of that. And so I started kind of leading into that space. And that, I think, has actually given me the survivability in this industry and a career. Because I think if I had just remained a host and just been really broad, like you said, those jobs really don't exist out there anymore.
What was the first show you produced on your own and shot it yourself?
Oh, my gosh. Like, I've never done anything exclusively on my own. Like, when I come on as an executive producer, I am the creative producer. So I've worked with Justin a lot, and Justin is a great logist. That was not me. Not me. That thing was not me. So
turn your mail off too. Turn your mail off.
This is just too funny. Okay. That really was not on my end. Okay. So I've worked with Justin a lot over the years, and Justin is a great logistics producer. Like, he is fantastic about dealing with people, organizational stuff. Like, he's fantastic. I don't like that side of it. I love creating it, and yeah. I love the story. I love the narrative. I love looking at the edits. Like, I love all of that. So, you know, I don't do shows myself from start to finish. I will usually have an idea and I will bring it to a production company, and then I will work with them to develop it and create it. And there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, which I often like. Not always. So
for like are most of these shows you do are an hour? Are these like, so like 40 whatever minutes of content?
32, I think is the standard for that. But right. Yeah. So the Shark Week shows are all an hour.
So how long does it take to make one episode, and how much footage are you going through?
So when we shoot, we will often be on location for about a week. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it's challenging because you're working with nature, right? So like, what are you going to do? Oh, where are the sharks? They should be here now. I mean, it's very challenging. Like the first Shark Week we did in Turks and Caicos, we sat the first 2 days, we got completely skunked. And I remember Casey and I did that show with Ping Pong, and Casey, myself, and Justin were in the room that night. And we were like, oh my God, we got to call the execs at Discovery and tell them there's no sharks here. Like, where can we pivot to? I was on Google Maps looking. I was like, oh my gosh, like what's the next island we can jump to? We have permits to do everything. So we have to chum, because here's the reality with sharks. Unless you put smell in the water, they're not going to show up. They don't care. So we were buying up every fish from every fisherman on the island and sending boats out in the morning ahead of us to start putting a chum slick in the water to attract these sharks, especially because these sharks are not habituated at all. Like, there are places like Tiger Beach where the boat rolls up and the shark's like, hello, you're going to feed me, right? It's Pavlov's dogs. But sure. In places like Turks and Caicos, they just are not used to that at all. So it took a long time to bring them in. So we had a week to get that. We ultimately did get the footage. For French Polynesia, we were on catamarans for, I believe, 10 days sailing through French Polynesia to different islands. And we got really lucky with the sharks there. But that's also like, that is shark paradise. That was the name of the show. Like, you really could drop your camera and film some sharks.
Right. Well, I mean, camera technology, you know, we've seen change. I remember the first things I shot, these guys are holding gigantic cameras over their shoulder and stuff like that. Now you got little DSL cameras and GoPros and everything else. How good are you? I know you hire camera guys, but do you shoot any stuff yourself down there, or are you good with any of that? Because I've seen you work a computer just now, and
So there's your answer.
I don't know if I want to trust you with a camera underwater.
You shouldn't, unless it's a GoPro. I mean, usually if I'm there for Shark Week, I'm on camera, so it doesn't make sense for me to have a camera in hand, because it also looks a little hokey if I'm like walking, you know, going around with a GoPro. So usually I'm sans camera. If I'm diving for myself, I always have a GoPro. I have an Insta360. The technology is so simple that even someone like me can figure it out. So no, the big cameras, like the really cool, the great stuff that like the Mark Rackleys of the world. Mark Rackley is like the old school go-to most amazing Shark Week cinematographer underwater you could ever meet. Like, I can't even tell you what camera he shoots with. I know it's big and it's cool.
Right. I mean, but when you think about it, I mean, if you were trying to do this show 20 years ago or 30 years ago, the amount of crap that you'd have to take and you know, the stuff you couldn't do yourself. You had to hire guys like him who are just specialists in this kind of thing. So, I mean, the technology has really kind of changed the game on this kind of stuff and probably brought production costs down, I would think.
100%. You know, I also think the technology changes so fast that a lot of these production houses that have their own gear, they're updating that gear once every few years. And I know the guys that own their own packages with their own cameras and their own lights, like they're doing that as well. And that stuff is not cheap. But to your point, you know, the technology that was exclusively the property of like networks at one point, I have friends, my friend Mina shoots with an underwater camera that is what you would use for Shark Week. You know, it's people have that in their just in their kit, their everyday kit, if they're passionate about something. And it's not cheap. But if this is your passion, it's relatively affordable compared to like the $100,000 cameras of yore.
So if you know there's sharks in the water and okay, we're going to go shoot stuff. Mm-hmm. How many of you go underneath? How many cameras are down there at one time?
So we will usually have one or two cameras in the water. Often it'll be me and Rackley. And then it'll be myself, maybe one of the scientists, Tristan Guthridge, Austin Gallagher. And then often we have safety divers. We have to have safety divers because we're all watching each other's backs, but there's almost always a safety diver in the water. And depending on when this airs, if it airs before or after the Shark Week episode, this week. Okay. So I can't reveal fully the story, but there was a moment on the Saba show where there were three of us in the water. It was myself, Rackley, and Connor Cassidy, who's an amazing safety diver and shark handler. And God bless that we were all there because we were with some wild sharks and they got frisky.
Okay. Yeah. Now that was going to be another question I was going to ask. I mean, what was the scariest moment that's happened in one of these dives?
It would be that. And okay. I can't describe it fully because I have a feeling they're going to tease the hell out of that for the Shark Week show.
Sure.
But I will tell you this, that the people on the boat, there were three of us in the water, and the people on the boat were like, you know, we were in the water and there was noise and they were cheering and they were yelling and this and that. When this happened, the boat went silent. And when I got out, we always have a trauma medic on board for obvious reasons. Knock on wood, we've never needed her, but we always have one. And she said to me, she goes, I was going to get my kit.
Oh my gosh.
She was like, we didn't know what happened, what they saw. And I can't fully describe it, but what their POV was and also what our POV was, it really could have gone in a number of directions.
Did you ever get completely skunked on a trip? Like the fish have not shown up. Like there's no sharks, there's no fish, and we got nothing to shoot. We're going to have to like bail.
No, the closest we came to that was in Turks and Caicos with the first 2 days. And again, that's also because those are not habituated sharks. And so we had to bring in wild sharks. So what we usually do, the areas that we go to are areas where scientists know they have gone, they have tagged, they have studied the sharks. We know that they're there. And usually when the scientists are tagging the sharks, they're also chumming for them. They're baiting for them. So they know that they can bring them in. So we do a lot of research. You know, we don't go to a place where people are like, once back in 1942, we saw a shark. Probably sure. Not yeah. What we need to go film. Like we know, we also know the seasons because a lot of it is seasonal. So we go to areas where we know that the chances are like 99.9% that we're going to have some shark interactions. You never know. I mean, you could go to a great place and there could be nothing, but fortunately that has not happened to us.
How about the roughest weather and the worst boat ride that you were out there? You're like, just get me off this thing.
Well, that actually would not be on a Shark Week show. That was on the series Enslaved that I did a few years ago. And that was about the transatlantic slave trade. We went all over and we were filming in the English Channel. And the English Channel is notorious for crazy weather, which is why there are so many shipwrecks there. And we were studying shipwrecks that were associated with the slave trade. And we got to Penzance and to our hotel, and our hotel was facing the water. And there was kind of like a little embarcadero and then a wall. That night, our hotel was shaking because the waves were pounding so hard. Oh, and we were all like, what are we going to do? So the first day we didn't go out. The second day we didn't go out. And then finally the third day we decided, the captain said, okay, I think we can probably get out. And it was about a 3-hour boat ride out to where we needed to go. The waves were so huge. They were breaking over the bow of our boat. And finally, our captain was like, we absolutely can't keep going. This is getting really dangerous. But also, I need to time this right because I can't turn around. The waves were coming so quickly that, and you don't want to be broadside to a wave because it's just going to flip you. So we were like, well, this is really scary. So he, of course, was fantastic and pulled the maneuver and was able to turn around and get us out of there. But it was so rough.
Wow. Yeah, that is scary. I can't remember if we talked about that the first time or hey, you had shot that yet. I'm trying to remember. But when did that air? And that sounds like an amazing show.
2020. That because we shot that in 2018 and 2019 and that aired in 2020.
Okay. So which brings me to 2020. Where were you when the world shut down? And did you ride it out here in California or were you somewhere else?
Well, I was actually in March of 2020. I was filming Enslaved and we were doing some pickups and we were just outside of Savannah, Georgia. We were somewhere in Georgia. And I remember my friends, Mina and Sophia, were going to see sharks in Bimini. And they were like, you know, Kinga, it's really weird because we weren't able to take the boat. We had to fly because apparently like that virus has been found here. And I was like, we're in the United States of America. We're going to be fine. Like, you know what? We're going to
The germs don't hit here.
It's going to be great. Listen, we've got the infrastructure. I understand it's been a problem in other parts of the world, but like we have the infrastructure. We got this. Like,
we got great leadership. What else could go wrong?
Yeah. Then I got home and I got an email from my friend Bo, who I love, and he's worked in the pharmaceutical world for years. And he literally sent me an email and he's like, Kinga, this thing's really terrifying. He's like, I'm telling you right now, this is going to be bad. And I was like, oh, if Bo says this, this is not good. So and from there, we know what happened. Bo was right.
How many episodes did you end up finishing and shooting?
We finished the whole series. There was one thing we wanted. I believe we wanted to end up in like Granada and film something there, like a really beautiful ending and like sink a gorgeous sculpture that represented all the people who had been lost to the slave trade. And we never got to finish that, but we got 99.9% of the show. So the show aired as is. And it was really fantastic. It was Samuel L. Jackson, who was the lead host, and we were the dive team. And it was really a powerful series to be a part of. And I think it was 6 episodes altogether.
Wow. Okay. What network was that?
That started on Epix and then it went to BBC. And I believe also made its way to Amazon because you know how they all kind of move around the world.
What surprised you the most about shooting that? And what did you learn most of all that you didn't know going in?
Oh gosh. I mean, I think just being on location, you know, I did a lot of research and I was obviously familiar with the horrors of the slave trade, but there were some really powerful moments. We were in filming in Suriname in South America, and we went to look for a ship called the Lusden. And the Lusden is really probably the greatest case of murder in the history of the slave trade. And it was basically the story of a ship that was going to Paramaribo full of slaves to sell. And they ran aground on a sandbar because they took a wrong turn up the wrong river and they ran aground on a sandbar. And they realized they weren't going to be able to save the ship. But the captain was afraid that if they released the slaves that they would mutiny and kill them. And they were pretty close to shore. So realistically, if they let people go, they could have gone into the forest. And those people were called maroons. The escaped slaves, the enslaved people would escape into the forest and become maroons. We actually got to visit a maroon village and they were the ancestors of these people. But instead, he nailed down the hatches. And as the waters rose, they sat on the hatches and listened to all these people drown. Oh. And it gives me chills even telling the story. Like it's just the ickiest of the icky, right? And then they went and filed insurance and basically claimed all those people and the ship as a loss.
Oh, so my gosh.
It was the grand details of the transatlantic slave trade, I think most of us who have, you know, read history are familiar with. But it's those details that a lot of people don't know about. Or we would go into the jungle and at that time, those were sugar plantations, coffee plantations, and they still had the remnants of the machines. And we got tours of all of this and got to see it. And it's not something that's really accessible to people because you have to go deep into the jungle and to find all of it. And there was this one crazy machine, and there were these like, it was just, they kind of looked like torture devices. And our guide with us, Leo Belai, he actually wrote a great book on the Luzdan. And he said, "Do you know why people would stand with a machete next to this?" And we said, "I don't, you know, to cut the sugar cane." They said, "No, to cut off people's arms, because if someone's arm got caught in the machine as they were pressing the sugar cane, it was more profitable for them to cut off their arm than to stop the entire machine."
Oh my gosh. And that's just horrifying.
I have chills. And it's horrifying because you realize that was a part of history, and that's kind of what humans did to each other. And
oh yeah. Well, yes. We learned that, you know, traveling the world, and the more you learn, just like you see what people are capable of.
Yeah.
And it's, it's rough. But I did hear about the sugar trade and how just really dangerous it was that mm-hmm. people don't realize, you know. I mean, we all know we're used to in the U.S., the cotton industry, which had its own, you know, problems, I mean, in terms of dangers and things like that. But sugar, just in the way it's made, there was so many things that could go wrong and things like that that are so dangerous and stuff. Oh, man.
There's also terrible environments. You know, coffee and sugar is often grown in very hot, humid environments. And it's not like these people were given air-conditioned, nice, comfortable.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, the life expectancy for someone who worked in one of those plantations was something ridiculous. Like it was like in the 20s because the conditions were so horrible and they were literally worked to death.
Oh, yeah. And then diseases like, you know, yellow fever and things like that took out a lot of people. But okay, let's lighten it up then.
Okay.
Let's go back to the water. And what – is there a normal – depth that you go to shoot these things that the sharks hang out at, and how deep can you go with the equipment, and what's safe and what is it?
So we do a variety of free diving, which I prefer. Free diving is apnea. It's on your own breath. I like that because you get to interact more closely with the animals. You're not, you know, Darth Vader with blowing bubbles all over the place. I also like it because you're very nimble. The problem with it is that you are bringing the sharks up to the surface and you're bringing them there with bait. And there are a lot of nuances to all of this. And this is why, you know, it really does require expertise to do it. For one, all sharks have different personalities. They're like dogs. And so some are going to be friendlier. Well, friendly is not the right word. Some are going to be more relaxed. And some are going to be more punchy and a little more what people would deem aggressive, but really they're just more inquisitive. Sharks don't have hands. They're going to test you. They're going to test you with their teeth. You have to understand their behaviors and how they're coming at you. And you have to react accordingly because it is very dangerous. And look, people, I'm a conservationist through and through, but when people are like, sharks are kind and sweet, sharks are 500 million year old killing machines. Their job is to kill and eat you. So will they do it every time? No, they're not mindless killers at all. Like, but if they think you're interesting, they're going to come and approach you and they're going to test you with their teeth. So when you are in a position like that, and especially when you bring them up to the surface, if you think about it logically, most things that are floating on the surface of the ocean, they're dead. Whales, turtles, whatnot. So if a shark sees something on the surface, it's like, oh, well, you're probably edible. Let's have a look at you.
Yeah. So and the seals surface, and stuff that they like. Yeah.
Exactly. So being on the surface has its own dangers associated with it. You have to be able to respond quickly. You have to be able to redirect sharks. You have to like position your body in a way so they understand what you are. You have to watch them. There are times when we've gotten out of the water. After that incident in Saba, I remember Mark Rackley was like, "We're done. We're getting out." It's just, they're too punchy. The water visibility. Sharks are also very smart. If the water visibility is bad, they know that that's their advantage.
Oh, okay.
So all of that. When you're at the bottom with sharks, you have a little bit more control. Then you're on scuba because obviously you can't free dive and sit down there, and we wear the full face masks. I don't love working with sharks on scuba because I feel clunky, and you know, the guys who do it all the time, they're used to it. I feel clunky when I'm down there, even though I've been a scuba diver for 20 years. I like to be able to very fluidly move. But even then, you know, you have bait in the water, and really what's super important, and what I've actually seen misfire in some videos where you have people in the water with sharks, like tourists, and the sharks will come and there'll be a bite because they have food in the water. You have to have current, because if you don't have current, that smell of the fish goes absolutely everywhere. And then you're just sitting in it and you're marinating. And the sharks, when they come in and they smell
you're marinating in the chum.
You are. You exactly what you're doing. And sharks have seven senses, but they're coming in with their sense of smell. And so they smell this fish and they come in. And if there's not a current, which a current is kind of the stream that's taking like that smell. And then if there's a current, they'll come directly to the bait box. Or if there's a feeder, they'll feed the shark moves on. But if there's no current and everyone's just marinating in the chum, the sharks will start sniffing around looking for where the fish is. And, you know, then they start testing things like air tanks and you know, people. So you don't want that to happen. So there are definitely things you need to do to stay safe.
But also the better light is closer to the surface if you're shooting, right? I mean, if you can go a certain depth, do you have to bring your own lighting and all that?
Yeah. So Mark Rackley and the guys who shoot underwater, they have the huge camera lights. You also lose colors underwater. So you have to filter that footage after anyway, but when you have light, it makes a huge difference. And we'll also do night dives. We'll often like shoot at night and bring sharks in at night. Those are, oh gosh, those I have to say are very creepy, because you can't see any further than the glow of the light. Oftentimes, like when we shoot Tiger Beach, it's 20 feet. We've been down to 60 feet, 100 feet. You know, you usually don't go a lot more than that because your bottom time is limited. So if you're a scuba diver, you know that you have You suck up all your air, but also you have your no decompression time. So if you're at a greater depth, you have less time before you have to do deco stops to come back up. So you're really like at around 100 feet is probably a good place to be max out for shooting.
I remember I did the blue hole in Belize, and everybody's like, oh, you're going to go to the blue hole. What was it like? What was it like? I said, well, first of all, the deeper you go, there's no color down there. It's just rocks. You know, it's not like colorful coral or anything like that. And you said it just gets darker and darker and colder. And you have to, the deeper you go, the slower you have to go down to regulate. And then you get like 5 minutes down there, and then you got to start on your way back up to slowly deregulate, you know? So it's just like, it's nice to say you did it, but you know, after you get, there's much more fun stuff to see at the top, you know, and in the first 30 feet, you know?
Can we just be really honest here? The blue hole is one of the most unimpressive dives I've ever done.
Right? It is. It's like a little cave. There's some stalagmites or whatever, stalactites and
both.
Okay.
Oh, so it's like a sunken cenote, essentially. So that was cool, but you're right. It's about 140, 150 feet, and there really isn't much to see. Like every now and then, maybe there's like a sleeping, you know, white tip reef shark. But the reefs around it, because if you did the tour, then they take you to, I think it's called like Aquarium Reef and a couple of reefs. Those are spectacular because Belize is amazing and the diving's amazing. But people have that surface visual of the blue hole. And I think it's actually much cooler from the surface, from like a drone shot.
Yeah, it's big round circle. It's cool, blue, and it's neat to look at. But when you're in it, it's just, okay, it's dark, it's cold, there's nothing down here to see. It'd be like, and now we got to go back up and we're almost out of air. It's like, what are we? Okay, you did it. Yeah, if they didn't add those two nice dives afterwards, you'd feel ripped off. You'd be like, oh, this was a lot of work to not see much. So you talked about free diving, and that's something I always wanted to try because I've been a scuba diver for 30 years. But the free diving, how much training does it take? How long can you hold your breath now? And how deep can you go?
So their training for free diving is FII, and there are other schools as well. And it's really important. You know, you can go, you're not required to. You know how with scuba diving, like if you show up at a dive shop, you can't rent gear or dive unless you are PADI or SSI certified. There's no such thing with free diving. If you want to free dive, go for it. However, I would advise everyone to take the class because there's a lot of safety. Like from the holding of your breath and the breathing techniques to the actual safety of being with somebody else, making sure you never free dive alone. I can't say that enough. That's so dangerous. But they teach you breathing techniques. So for free diving level one, for instance, you have to go to a depth of 66 feet and you have to be able to hold your breath 3 minutes static. And static means you're not moving. So you put your hands on the side of the pool, you put your face in the water, and after the breathing exercises, you put your face down and you're in the water for 3 minutes. I see your eyes. And here's the truth. You could do it in a heartbeat. It is completely mental.
Three minutes. Standing in the pool.
Yeah, 100%. So
okay. Active, yeah, I think I could do that.
You could do that. You could with the right breathing technique. So you have to breathe up. You do the stomach breathing. So it's not just in your chest. You take the deep breaths. You breathe for about 2 to 3 minutes. And then you hold your breath and you put your face in the water. Now, active means that you are actually moving around underwater. And that burns a lot more oxygen. Now, the professional free divers, the guys who go to like crazy depths, which I am not at all, they will actually even close their eyes because your brain processing visual cues burns oxygen. So when you're underneath, it's usually half of your time of static. So I think my max time moving around underwater is about 2.5 minutes, but that's not normal. Like that was quite at a shallow depth because depth also matters because it's compression. I'm usually around like a minute 30, and I don't really need to be down there much longer. So when we like free dive or spearfish, that's it.
Are you spearfishing these days? I know you would always post photos of like, you would go to like Catalina and hold up a lobster or something. Are you still doing that?
I haven't done it in a while. Actually, I haven't gotten out to Catalina to spearfish in a while, but we used to do it quite a bit and it was really great. Like there's something about harvesting your own food. And also as a conservationist, I think the idea, I'm not a vegan, I eat meat, but I do think it's really important to source your own food. You know, when there's a lot of talk nowadays with, you know, documentaries like David Attenborough's Ocean that talk about like the overharvesting of the ocean, and well, there's 8 billion of us. Of course we are. But I think there's really something to be said for going out there and selecting your own fish. Because really what's problematic when you boil it down is anything on a commercial scale, right? Like when you send nets down there and you are just taking everything that's in the ocean.
Well, to catch. I don't want to like name the Chinese by name, but I mean, this is not a good thing that they're going around the world with these, you know, 24-hour trawlers and just taking everything out of the ocean. I mean, I'm not absolving America of any blame either, but in the last 10, 20 years, you got to admit it's not good. I mean,
I will name them by name.
And okay, good.
More than just that. I did a lot of research on this. I actually contributed to a story for Forbes that my friend Joe Sills wrote. And I was really frustrated because do you remember a couple of years ago, I don't know if it was 2018, 2019, it was mostly Chinese, Taiwanese fishing vessels that were sitting out of the exclusive fishing zone in the Galapagos in Ecuador.
Yes.
And there were reports that they were turning off their AIS, which is their locator positioning, which legally you have to have on, and that they were actually going into the fishing areas. But even if they weren't, the problem is like fish aren't looking at this and going, oh, well, this is sharks, fish, you know, you name it. Nothing is looking at the water and saying, oh, here's a boundary. I shouldn't cross this. So they were just sitting there and they were harvesting right outside of like the Galapagos. And I was like, why is the Ecuadorian government allowing this? This is crazy. Like if I were Ecuador, I'd be like, get out, 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 out. And I started digging and I started talking to some sources on the ground in Ecuador. And then I started doing research and it turned out that what China does is they come into, and you probably know this.
I know this story because I've been traveling through Africa for the last 20 years.
And you know, they do the same thing in Africa and they come in. And they indebt countries to them. So they build infrastructures. They build roads.
It's like, hey, it looks like you need an airport. And they're like, yeah, we do need an airport. And like, we'll build it here in like 2 years. They're like, great. What do you want? And they go, see all those waters out there? Oh, you mean the protected ones? And they go, are they? Are they protected? We want fishing rights to all that. Or the lands, you know, I've seen them do this. you know, we want mining rights to all that over there. But those are protected for the animals. Are they?
Are they?
You know, and then, okay, how bad do you want a new power station? Well, we do need a new power station. So this is what they do around the world. And then and Galapagos is one of those things.
Yeah. That's the debt
tough.
that had been accumulated at the time by Ecuador to China was something like $4 billion. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's why they're not kicking them out, because they can't.
Every construction site in Africa, when I was in Zimbabwe, in Kenya, and Tanzania, like in the cities, and in Ethiopia, all Chinese.
Yep.
Every big building going up, the airport construction, everything, all Chinese companies.
Yep. There it is. Yeah. We said it. I mean, at some point you kind of, you know, it just is.
Yeah.
And every conservationist that works in the ocean knows this. And they're all like, I've seen the Chinese longliners in the protected waters, seen them in all these areas. So
yeah. It is. And usually, I mean, and I love Japan, you know, but I mean, that's the only, you know, that as a diver and, you know, someone who loves the ocean, that's the only slight I have on the Japanese is like, they will eat anything that comes out of the ocean. When you go to the markets, you're like, oof, boy. Whales too. Yeah, the whales is a Norway too. Come on. We don't need to eat the whales anymore.
Yeah.
Come on. Do you have any place? I know that you're attuned to all this. Is anybody have any good news anywhere? I mean, do you see anybody doing a good job?
Yeah, you know, this is something that I think is really worth discussing. And this is something that we talked about as Shark Allies and kind of me as a conservationist and also as a human. I really have gone in the direction of, instead of calling, you know, sometimes it's necessary. Like, we can sit here and talk about China all day long, but, and sometimes it's necessary, but I think it's just so much more beneficial to talk about what's good and highlight the positive and things that are working, because I think the world is honestly just tired of being beat over the head. Like, for Shark Allies, we made a very conscious decision a long time ago to not show, you know, sharks with their fins cut off fighting for air, because we decided, listen, the world that you turn on the news and you're just going to get like the worst of the worst all day long. People don't want to see this. They're just going to change the channel. It's like the Sarah McLachlan song. Do you remember in the Angels? And it was like the poor dogs in shelters.
The PETA, yeah.
I love shelter animals, but I changed the channel because I couldn't watch that anymore. So
yeah,
it doesn't work for people. So for me, I think it's more about highlighting places like French Polynesia that have one of the largest protected marine sanctuaries in the world and one of the largest shark sanctuaries. And their reefs and their nature is off the charts. Like, it is beautiful. They have stunning coral reefs. They have so much big fauna in the water. The whales that come through July to September, like, oh my gosh, the sharks that you can find there. It's incredible. They're doing something right. But their tourism numbers are pretty low, and they are staunch conservationists, and there's a lot of power in the hands of the local people.
So I got to snorkel with the whales in Moorea when I was there last year, and that was amazing. So other than Moorea, and because there's only a couple places in the world, they said you could snorkel with the humpbacks, and that was one of them. So I found myself there around that time of year. It's like, well, I'm staying to see this. Other than Moorea, where else in French Polynesia do we have to go as divers and snorkelers, in your opinion? This is where you put on your expert hat.
So French Polynesia is actually 118 islands. My goal is to make it to all of them because it's so beautiful. Justin and I spent time in the Marquesas. Those are extraordinary, so very different. There's the Society Islands, which most Americans know Bora Bora, probably Tahiti, probably Moorea. I love the Tuamotu atolls. So that's like Tikihau, Rangiroa, Fakarava. If you are a diver, Fakarava is one of the most extraordinary places in the world. They have two passes, and it is the highest concentration of gray reef sharks in the world. And there's a National Geographic documentary we shot there for Shark Week. It's Justin and I stayed after and went diving there, and you can't believe it. You feel like you're in a National Geographic documentary where the sharks you're surrounded by hundreds of gray reef sharks. That's amazing. I love Tiki Hau. Some of my favorite tiger sharks that I can name by name are in Tiki Hau there. French Polynesia, every island is different and they all offer something great. Even diving off of the big island of Tahiti, like they're great places to go.
So the hardest part about that though is just getting there to some part. I mean, I'm assuming you got to fly to Tahiti first, you know, Papeete or something, and then take a little puddle jumper, I guess. And that starts to add up after a while. It's just the expense of, I mean, on the one hand, it kind of keeps it from getting overrun, which is good. On the other hand, it's expensive and kind of a pain in the ass to get to.
It is. So, but you know, I think some of the best places in the world are the ones that are hard to get to.
It protects the reef.
Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword. I mean, we're lucky because we live in Los Angeles. So yeah, the main island of Tahiti is 8 hours for us. Is it 8 hours? Yeah, it's 8 hours.
Yeah, it's eight. It's only a couple more than going to Hawaii.
Exactly. Which people are always so shocked by. And then, so you take Air Tahiti Nui over, and then you can buy Air Tahiti packages, which are like the jumpers, and you can go to some of the other islands. They're not cheap by any means, but you can buy like a package so that you can jump to specific islands. But again, you know, I hope that it stays that way, because I think if it becomes too accessible, it's going to turn into, I love Hawaii. I think Hawaii is wonderful, but the reefs in Hawaii are kind of ruined. And Tahiti is Hawaii 100 years ago. And it's just, there's even a statistic that Tahitian Tourism told me, and it's something like Hawaii gets as many visitors in a week as Tahiti gets in a year. And that's all the Hawaiian islands combined and all the Tahitian islands combined. But holy crap, that's a big difference.
Right. Well, as a diver, I mean, I have a bucket list that I still haven't gotten to. One is Palau that I have not been to, and I'm sure you have.
I haven't.
Come on.
No.
Really?
No, it's on my list too. It's on my list. Yeah. There are a lot of places I haven't been to.
Well, what else besides there that you haven't, that you're dying to get to?
Maldives, I think. I really think that's going to be top of the list.
Okay. Yeah. And you've done the Red Sea, like in Egypt?
No, I haven't done the Red Sea either.
Okay. Now you need some crew, you know, but I can't, I'll be your Justin for some of those, but I'm wearing a shirt. I'm telling you that right now.
Yeah.
These abs don't need to be seen anymore. Not by the general public at all. So, I mean, I know there's different kinds of sharks. I mean, there's a million different kinds of sharks. There's lemon sharks, tiger sharks, reef sharks, all this great whites. Do you have a favorite that you love to shoot and be around?
So I would say my specialty and the ones that I love the most are tiger sharks. They're the ones that I work with the most. They're the ones that I'm the most familiar with. And I love them. I think they're beautiful. I think they're amazing sharks. I think oceanic white tips are also extraordinary sharks. They're really, really cool to be around. Quite punchy, but yeah, cool to be around.
How about the ones that annoy you the most?
Reef sharks, man, like Caribbean reef sharks.
The black tip ones?
No, just the Caribbean reefs, the regular Caribbean. Okay. They can be really feisty. And oftentimes when we're working somewhere in the Caribbean, you'll have tiger sharks around, but you'll also get a lot of the reef sharks around. And the reef sharks, when you have to redirect a tiger shark, most of the time they're very slow moving. And, you know, you can push them down, kind of down and away is the standard thing. It always makes me laugh because you see influencers on Instagram being like, if there's ever a tiger shark, you push it down and away. And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure people are going to be able to keep their cool. And
yeah, right.
When it's coming at him. But that is accurate. Like down and away, stay away from the sharp end. Don't put your hand in their mouth. But with certain species of sharks, oceanic white tips and Caribbean reefs, like you don't want to touch them with your hands because the way they move is so erratic and so fast that they'll take your hand. And that's not a good thing.
No.
So I will usually block with my dive fins if they come a little too close. But if there's bait in the water, they get really punchy.
Oh, oof. How about I did this and I'm on the fence about it. The shark cage diving, and like I did the great whites down in South Africa.
Amazing.
I mean, but there's a, you know, some conservation people have said that's not a good thing. I mean, they were very pro shark and they're saying like, they're trying to demystify these things by putting us down there, but also, is it a good thing? What do you think?
You know, everyone has their own opinion. I think it is. Unfortunately, you were probably, whenever you went, you were probably one of the last few people to get to do that because in
South Africa, did they stop it?
Well, they've essentially had to stop it because the sharks are gone. And it's mostly because of habitat loss and food source disappearing. And the sharks are, there's not a viable shark diving industry there anymore. We used to go out to Guadalupe a lot with Shark Allies, and I would go out personally. And that was a really great place that got shut down as well. And that's actually very unfortunate that got shut down. I am of the mindset, there are a lot of purists, and I work with some people who are in wildlife conservation who are purists. They're like, don't look directly at the animal. You know, don't set foot in a forest. And I'm like, that doesn't work. There are 8 billion of us on this planet, and we share space with these animals. You know, I get woken up at night because there are coyotes hunting in my backyard. We've infringed on their space a lot. And I do think that when it comes to sharks, you know, people have a lot of commentary about chumming for sharks. And my commentary is this: if you're talking about chumming from a boat, that ship sailed literally 2,000 years ago. Sharks have been following boats for 2,000 years. They've made the connection to boats, food. They used to throw everything from livestock to people to waste overboard. And sharks are very familiar that boats equal food. Sharks are quite smart, actually. But I think that there's immense value. You could say the same thing about safaris. Are we infringing on their space? Are we changing behavior? Sure. But is there a value? And I think you have to put it on a scale. When people go out and they see these animals, or like your experience with these white sharks in South Africa, you probably got to see them from what they are. You know, they're not trying to pry you out of the cage and eat you. Like, they're really beautiful, amazing animals. And I've seen people's reactions when they get out of the water from diving with sharks, and they have a completely different perspective on these animals than what the media sold them for years. So yes, I think there is a lot of value with very good animal encounters. And I think it's incredibly important to source your outfitters well and make sure that you're going with people who are respectful and responsible. But yeah, you know, there's my friend Lindsay is going to be taking people to dive with orcas in Norway. And some people are like, oh, I don't know about that. And I'm like, well, you know what? Look, it's an extraordinary experience. And if you go with someone who respects the animals and doesn't infringe on their space and doesn't chase them, these are huge ocean predators. If they want to get away from you, they will. Do I think like in Mexico, there needs to be 30 boats chasing a pod of orcas? No, they should have regulations around it. Absolutely.
Right. But that sounds so cold. Diving with orcas in Norway. Oh my God. I did my first in Iceland last year. I did a dry suit, which I had never done before. Yeah. When you touch the tectonic plates at the park.
Done that.
Oh my gosh. And that was just a weird feeling, being just like that thing squeezing your neck, that collar. I'm not a fan. Have you done the cold water diving a lot?
I've done Silfra, where you went, which is extraordinary. That water is so cold.
And clear, though. Amazingly clear.
The clearest water you could ever imagine. That is just an incredible dive. I've done some really cold water diving for Enslaved. The English Channel was freezing. We had dry suits for that. We did the Great Lakes. That was murky and very, very cold. Mm-hmm. I do not like dry suits at all. I think they're actually quite dangerous. You have to be certified for dry suits, and you have to be very proficient in them, because if you get too much air in them, they can shoot you to the surface. I don't find them comfortable. I like free diving suits. So I have a free diving suit that is a 6 mil that is actually designed for diving under the ice. And I tested it against a dry suit, and my free diving suit was actually warmer and a lot more comfortable than the dry suit.
For me, it was my hands, you know, because it's like, because you're staying dry, but your hands are not. You're in like normal scuba stuff. So water does get in. Mm-hmm. And my hands were freezing, even though there were like mittens. I was trying to like clench my fist together. It was so cold.
That it's funny you say that, because it was my sister and I, we did Silfra. And when we got out, I already have problems with my hands that if they get too cold, they get really painful. I was in so much pain in Silfra. I was fine in the suit. I could even handle it around my neck, which I don't normally, I don't like really tight fitted things, but my hands were in pain. So since then I had gloves made that are really, really thick and protect my hands, because it's super painful to be in cold water.
Oh my gosh. Okay. What reef would you say? So this is, as someone who's been diving for many years, like the Caribbean now, I don't even bother to go much anymore. Not only for the lack of fish, but for the reefs are just trashed in terms of color and things. Where do you see some color in reefs, and where can we go to see like that bright old fashioned kind of colorful reef? Are they still out there? Where do you go?
French Polynesia. Honestly.
All right. You're selling me on this.
So far, you know, again, we talked about the places we'd still like to go in the future, but to me, thus far in my life, French Polynesia has the best diving I've ever seen. The cleanest reefs, the healthiest ecosystem, the, you know, best wildlife. I really think it's gorgeous. And to the point we made before, it's because they are so fiercely protective.
Okay. Now I got to go back. I'm going to check it out for sure. Okay. Now get your plugs in. Oh, we didn't talk about Tom Bergeron. What the hell's that about? Give me a Tom Bergeron story. And what were you doing?
So Tom is hosting a show for Shark Week, and he has publicly announced that, and that's really awesome. And since we are in the Shark Week family, we become friends and gone hiking and had fun. Tom is the kindest, loveliest, sweetest, like they call him America's dad. And I'm like, you're America's dad. Like he's the nicest human on the planet. And I just, you know, hanging around with him is lovely. Like he is what everyone in television should be.
Well, that's so funny because it's like we just talked about how the business has changed. He was one of those last guys who did everything. You know, he's doing Dancing with the Stars. He's doing game shows. He's doing America's Funniest Home Videos. And now he's doing Shark Week.
Yeah.
Did you go in the water with him?
No, I didn't get to go in the water with him. I know that he was on location. I don't think he did any diving, but he was on location and he's in the Shark Week family now.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So give us the plug. Give us all your websites and social media and where can people see you?
It is all King of Phillips. So my website is King of Phillips. My Facebook is King of Phillips. My Instagram is King of Phillips. And then I have links on there for all my shows. And then as Shark Week gets announced this year, I get to do 3 shows, which is really exciting. And they will probably announce those closer to date. So Shark Week is July 20th this year.
You can't say the names of the shows or we just look up.
I can't yet. No. No,
I'm trying to get a scoop.
I know. If this aired later, I'd give you the scoop, but I can't just yet. But you do know about the Sable one. That's not public.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty good. Why did you leave your longtime home of Malibu to go to Oxnard? You go up the coast more. Did you be closer to the Channel Islands or did you buy a house? What happened?
So I lived in Malibu for 13 years and then I moved to Marina Del Rey. And then my mom is up here in Oxnard. And after my dad passed away, she's 85 and, you know, she lives alone. She doesn't drive. So I was like, I got to be closer to my mama.
That's very sweet.
So I'm up here. Yeah.
What's it like? I know. That's one of those places I drive through all the time and never stop.
You know what I love? I'm not a city girl. Like that's why I always lived in Malibu. Even when I lived in Marina Del Rey, people were like, what are the great restaurants? And I'm like, I don't know, but I know that I drive 45 minutes every day to go to Malibu to go hiking. So what I love about Oxnard is its proximity to Ojai, to Santa Barbara, and then to Northern Malibu. Like the hikes in Northern Malibu and the surfing there is bar none. It's great. It's beautiful. So to me, that's the most important part. The city is kind of like take it or leave it. You know, you can find some good food here, but and we do have some cool beaches. Silver Strand is really cool.
Have you gone out to the Channel Islands and done it? I heard there's great hikes and kayaking and all that other stuff out there.
Yeah, I've been out to the Channel Islands a couple times. It's great. There's great. You can camp out there. Just watch out for the foxes because they will steal your food and pee in your tent.
Ooh.
Yes, that's what they do. But it's gorgeous. There's great diving. We would go out. There's a boat called the Spectre that goes out of Channel Islands Harbor and you can get on that and you can either scuba dive or you can free dive and you get to dive the kelp forest and it's really beautiful. You just reminded me, I need to get back out there. Yeah. And my friend Ryan actually runs orca trips out of Oxnard now and they've been going out to the Channel Islands and they have had amazing luck seeing orcas. You don't get in the water with them, but you see them from the boat.
And thank God your timing, but you got out right before a massive fire in the fires in Malibu. So, and we all know people that were affected there. Yeah. So, you know, God, yeah. Thank God you're okay. And any personal trips coming up?
I am heading back. I'm actually on call right now. I am waiting. I'm going to head back to Destin and Fort Walton Beach, where we are working with the Tiger Sharks. And that was a show that I mentioned that we have with a production company, but it's not greenlit yet. So we are going to go out there and film, and we're going to tag them. So as soon as the guys there tell me that the sharks have arrived en masse, and also that the June grass and the weather conditions are great, I'm going to hop on a plane and I'm going to head to Destin, Fort Walton Beach, Pensacola. It's all kind of there, which I love that area anyway. I love it. Okay. So go down.
Oh, and you're going to see our friend Meredith?
Yes.
Who lives down there? She did the show. I had her on a couple.
Tell her hi for me.
Yeah, she did it a couple years ago. We had her on.
Oh my gosh, I have to see it. Oh, I love Meredith. Like, Meredith is just a soul sister of mine. And I see her and her husband every time I go. And last time I was there, I stayed with them and she made the best steak I've ever had in my life. And then her husband made this margarita that just like, I think about this all the time. Like, I'm hungry now and I'm like, I want that.
Oh yeah, I got to look them up next time I'm there.
Yeah, they're great.
Oh, I forgot to ask if people want to see Great Whites. I know the numbers are down all over, but where would you send them?
You know, because Guadalupe is shut down and essentially the industry doesn't exist in South Africa anymore. I mean, kind of the new hotspot that's become that, but I don't know if there are commercial outfitters out there yet, is Stewart Island in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
That's kind of become the new Guadalupe, especially for like Shark Week filming. That's where they've been heading. But here's the reality, whether people want to hear it or not, they're all up and down our coast. I don't know if you follow Carlos. He's the Malibu artist on Instagram, and he's a friend and just an amazing drone operator. And he captures footage of white sharks off our coast every single day. And it's actually a great message because they are there, and he captures footage of them interacting with surfers, and the surfers are completely oblivious, kayakers, you know, you name it. And here's the reality. If they wanted us, none of us would be here. So they're there.
Oh, yeah. I've like gone surfing. I go like once or twice a year, go surfing down in San Onofre with some friends. And
I love San Onofre.
Yeah. And we go down there and we'll look on the beach, you know, just checking out the waves. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, there's a shark over there. There's one. And my friend who lives down there goes, yeah, they're here every day. Yeah. You know, so, you know, people have no idea. Just like I'm in the South Bay here. And it's the same thing. They're there, but they don't mess with you.
Nope.
I'm more excited to see porpoises, you know, dolphins.
Yes. Oh, they're so fun.
Dolphins are the best.
Yeah.
I still like get excited, like scream like a kid whenever I see a dolphin. Oh my God, there's dolphins. They're the best. Right? Finally, what do you think? And I asked you this the first time because I asked everybody, but all this travel and all that you've seen, we can go from the last few years and everything. What has it taught you about the world, yourself? How has it changed you?
I think what it's really taught me is there are great people everywhere. And I think as the world becomes more crowded and anonymous and, you know, in many ways oppressive, I guess, it's important to remember that on an individual level, there are so many great humans out there. And going out and actually interacting with people on a one-on-one basis instead of just kind of blanket covering that in what you read in the news or see on social media is, I think, so incredibly important because we've become desensitized in a large degree to different mindsets and different types of people and different ways of life. And when you actually go and interact with people and spend time with them, it's completely different. And I encourage everyone to do that.
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks, King. I'm glad we could do this finally again.
Me too.
It was so great to run into you in a hotel lobby in Miami. And hopefully we'll see you. I'll see you in person around here at some point.
Yes, that'd be lovely.
I'll go visit Oxnard.
Yeah, come on up. We've got
all. Yeah, all roads need to lead to Oxnard.
They kind of do.
Easy drive. All right, thank you so much, King of Phillips. Everybody,
thank you.
For spontaneous travelers, winging it is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.